Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program.
Every serious fiction writer I've ever known can identify a book or two that were seminal to their maturation or inspiration as an author. For me, there were three. There was A World According to Garp by John Irving. There was White Noise by Don DeLillo. And then there was Bright Light, Big City by Jay McInerney. When the book had attracted a lot of attention, I decided to buy a copy. It was hip, exciting, energetic, and it was written in a fresh style. It was written in second person as opposed to first or third person, like the vast majority of books are written. And so there's a constant you being told, you, the reader, you, the person out there. In fact, let me just read a short excerpt from Bright Lights and Big City, just to underscore that the power of the second person writing style. Just outside the door, you spot her, tall, dark, and alone, half hidden behind a pillar at the edge of the dance floor. You approach laterally, moving your stuff like a bad spade through the slalom of synthesized conga rhythm. She jumps when you touch her shoulder. Dance? She shakes her head. Why is she looking at you as if you have tarantulas nesting in your eye sockets? You are by any chance Bolivian or Peruvian? She is looking around for help now, remembering the recent encounter with a young heiress bodyguard at Danceteria. Or was it the red parrot? You back off, hands raised over your head. Just as an example, again, that's quoting a short passage from Bright Lights, Big City. Not only was it written in second person, but the protagonist is never really named in the book. And no. Further immersing the reader into the story in a way that you could be the protagonist, that the story is about the reader himself or herself. That right. book absolutely exploded on the scene. 700,000 copies sold is the last count that I had heard, plus tens of thousands a year for years after that. That book was authored by the man in the spotlight during this episode. His name is Jay McInerney, of course. A guy really needs no introduction. Jay McInerney is the author of 12 books. They include the aforementioned Bright Lights, Big City, Model Behavior, The Good Life. His short story collection, How It Ended, was named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times. His work has appeared in New York Magazine, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, New York Times Book Review, The Times Literary Supplement, New York Review of Books, on and on. He also writes a monthly wine column. We'll talk a little bit about wine and grapes and the magical effect of wine in social situations and such. That monthly wine column he wrote for Town and Country, and previously wrote a wine columnist for the Wall Street Journal and House and Garden. And many of those columns were collected in a book titled Bacchus and Me, Bacchus being the god of wine. And also a book titled A Hedonist in the Cellar. And in 2006, Jay McInerney was named James Beard MFK Fisher Award recipient for distinguished writing. And in 1989, he was named Literary Lion by the New York Public Library. Some of his other books include titles such as The Last of the Savages and The Last Bachelor and The Business and so on. Jay McInerney, thank you for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
I just can't.
I'd forgotten half of that,
I did ring a bell when I was reading some of the excerpt from the book.
good to know. I just when I was named a literary lion, I remember sneaking off to the bathroom with Hunter Thompson and
Well, now you're in trouble.
sharing some of his excellent drugs before trying to get back to the dinner party that was celebrating us.
Well, this is such a signature book for the era, and this was really any author's dream. Here's your first novel, and my understanding is that you and your publisher didn't really expect it to do what it did. They were expecting it to sell some books, but it became a huge sensation. And that's the case that it was like, wow, we weren't expecting this, but here we go.
Yeah, well, I was honestly, I was just kind of I was hoping to get enough good reviews that I could get a teaching job out of the whole thing. The book was, as you mentioned earlier, it was written in the second person, which isn't perhaps the, at least at the time, we didn't think it was the most reader-friendly mode. And it was, it was considered in-house. It was considered a fairly literary book, that is, it was not considered, Jekyll and Suzanne, Frederick Forsyth kind of bestseller material, to name some bestsellers of the era. And, I remember Jason Epstein, who was the president of Random House at the time, took me out to lunch, and he was fortunately a fan of the book, which was really how it got published. He took me out to lunch at Lutèce and bought me some very expensive wine. But he warned me, he said, first of all, he said, number one, people your age don't read anymore. I was 27 at the time, I believe. And he said, number two, people don't care about New York City. New York City is not a good subject for a book. I subsequently, well, many people who followed in my wake subsequently proved that wrong, since their Bright Lights partly spawned a huge avalanche of books about New York,
Yes.
culminating with the Bonfire of the Vanities. And thirdly, he said it's written in the second person, which is kind of weird, but he said I happen to like it. But he just basically said, don't get your hopes up. And that was the feeling in-house. I think the first printing was 5,000 copies, and we were all flabbergasted when the first printing immediately sold out, largely on word of mouth. And at that time, it took 6 weeks to reprint a book. So the feeling then, of course, was that it would die in those 6 weeks because everybody would forget about it. Fortunately, it didn't. Fortunately, the lack of product only sort of fed the appetite for the book, it seems. And so suddenly, before I knew it, I was the toast of the town, and I was the book was selling tens of thousands of copies a week, and movie rights were sold, and every actor of that generation was courting me in order to play the lead role. People like Tom Hanks and Alec Baldwin and Tom Cruise and Rob Lowe and on and on
I saw the movie, but I don't remember who was the lead role.
and on.
It was a long time
Well,
ago.
the movie was actually written by me, which was probably a mistake. One of the reasons it wasn't as good could have been, since I'm not a professional screenwriter. But it was it starred Tom, sorry, Michael J. Fox, who at that time was sort of
Oh, that's right.
the hottest actor out there. The problem was that he was known for this very clean-cut role in a TV show called Family Ties.
Yes.
And his image and my image were, diametrically opposed. As it turns out, we were quite similar. Personally, we ended up spending an awful lot of nights in the town in New York while he was filming Bright Lights, Big City. How he ever made it to the set at 6 in the morning every day, I have no idea.
Why
but
6 in the morning? He had other obligations later in the day, so it had to be done early.
no, that's just when they start filming movies, is it 6 in the morning?
Okay.
One of the
Interesting.
reasons that I probably didn't go into the film business, being a night person myself. But Tom is a very sorry, Michael is a very good actor. I keep saying Tom because Tom Cruise for 6 or 8 months was scheduled to be the lead, and Tom followed me around the New York nightclubs and so on in order to basically base the part on me. And then there were delays in production, and along came this movie called Top Gun, and so Tom ran off and did Top Gun. Michael J. Fox came along, and he was a great actor, but his image was such that it was very hard for his fans to see him in a sort of decadent New York role, which involved him snorting a lot of coke. And so his I don't think his fans were pleased, and my smaller legion of fans were definitely not pleased with my
Yeah.
character being played by this incredibly clean cut,
Happens
formerly
so often.
Republican
Happens so
star.
often.
So people come up to me, every month or every week even, say they just saw the movie because it's always playing somewhere. But I'm not a big fan of the movie. I just think I failed to figure out how to translate the very unusual narrative of the novel onto film.
Yeah,
It
that's the
was
key. I mean, to any listener out there, read the book. Don't see the movie, but read the book. If you're only going to do one thing, read the book, because as you say, it's the narrative is just not something that translates so well on the film, and you don't get the sense of immersion in the movie.
And also it was directed by a guy, James Bridges, who's a very good director, but he was at the time he must have been 62 years old, 65 years old. I'm afraid I'm that old now, but he just didn't get it. He didn't really understand the subtext of the novel. He didn't understand why people wait outside nightclubs for hours trying to get in, and he didn't really understand the allure of what was inside. I mean, just to use one example. So
Right.
it,
So
I mean, it just. It wasn't it, at the time it was the number one movie, but it really wasn't a great success. The other thing that happened was that by the time they filmed the movie, Len Bias, the basketball player, had died of a coke overdose,
yes, I remember. Yeah.
and Nancy Reagan was going full steam ahead on this Just Say No campaign, and there was a great fear among the filmmakers of glamorizing decadence and cocaine use and so on. So we had a bit of a problem even
I can
before.
imagine. So you didn't get a lot of pushback on second person. That was like, well, it's a little odd compared to most books, but they didn't really push back hard. The book
Great thing is
explode.
most people didn't notice it.
Yeah, that's amazing to me, because that to me was such a mark of distinction of the book. The immediate success that you and I describe for us what it was like to go from, an aspiring author to suddenly being the toast of New York. I'm sure that you were invited to every literary party in New York City and were rubbing shoulders with Tom Wolfe and Norman Mailer and Hunter doing some things with Hunter Thompson.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was pretty extraordinary. I was an unemployed would-be author who had recently been fired from the New Yorker for being a bad fact checker.
Like the character in the book.
And I had recently enrolled in the PhD program, literary program at Syracuse University, mainly so I could rub shoulders with Raymond Carver, who was teaching there at the time. And suddenly I found myself, flying to New York City from Syracuse, New York, of all places, like twice a week, and getting interviewed on the Today Show, and having drinks with Mick Jagger, who was interested in having me interview him for Esquire magazine, and getting invited. I'd been living in New York for 3 years before this, before I retreated in disgrace to Syracuse. So I knew New York pretty well, and suddenly all these nightclubs that I had trouble getting into were begging me to grace their dance floors. I remember about this time a nightclub called the Palladium opened up, and it was this huge Steve Rubell production. It was the biggest nightclub that had ever opened, and it was sort of the apotheosis of that whole idea. After you know, nightclubs were supposed to be underground; they weren't supposed to be, you know, big media sensations. But anyway, there must have been 1,000 people at the door of this place trying to get in. And I was with some friends of mine way at the back of the line. And we basically said, oh, hell, we might as well give up on this. And suddenly the doorman sees me, waves me, plows through the crowd of hundreds of people and drags me inside. And that was pretty much the way that it went for the next few years.
They want the right people in the club.
This was one of the first times that I had ever experienced, you know, the power of this new celebrity of mine. And it was, I mean, mostly it was great, but of course there was the inevitable.
Did it scare you at all? Was any of it scary?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't smart enough to be scared, but
you're still young and having just a great time.
Yeah, I was having a good time, but there was certainly a backlash. You know, there were a lot of people who felt that a novelist should not be in this position, and that a novelist shouldn't be a celebrity, and that I was somehow selling out, and you know, there was a lot of resentment. You know, I it was funny. I recently found something online. That was written about 20 years ago, but it basically said, if I had had a worse haircut and dressed more poorly, and looked more like a doofus, my literary reputation would be much higher than it was at the time.
I get it. No, you mentioned power, the power of celebrity, but your power also was one of the ways it expressed itself is that Bret Easton Ellis and Tama Janowitz came along as well. And I think your book fueled their rise as novelists as well. And the three of you were members of the so-called Brat Pack in the 1980s, novelists who came along and with this whole new sort of style and vision. Are all three of you still in touch?
Well, two of us are in touch, but it was a funny thing because Brett's book was published. I can't remember. I actually reviewed Tama's first book for the New York Times, and I gave it a pretty good review. Brad came along about 9 months later, and his editor was a great friend of mine named Morgan Entrekin, and he said, "I've just found this book. It's amazing." He said, "I'm going to promote it as the West Coast Bright Lights Big City." And I said, yeah, whatever. I subsequently read the book, and Matt Brat on some literary panel. And we really kind of hit it off. And even though, in my mind, we were quite different writers, our styles were very different. Our subject matters were similar. You know, the young people, nightlife, drugs, and so on. And really, the media can't deal with style. They can't deal with the difference between, you know, romanticism and stoicism. And they, so they loved the fact. Brat and I were like, you know, we were both these young people writing about subject matter that hadn't made it into literature for a long time, you know, not since Jack Kerouac, really. And so we got lumped together, and then Tama came along, and she got lumped in with us, I guess. Again, having similar subject matter. So we all found ourselves at the same parties and getting the same invitations, And it's always much easier for, I mean, not to sound like Donald Trump, but it's much easier for the media to write about groups than it is about individual objects. You know, Three's Company. We suddenly were a phenomenon, and that in turn inspired a lot of other young writers to follow in our footsteps. So, and that again created more backlash in the long run. But we were. There's no question that we had a large impact on the culture at a certain moment. And for some people, that was a very good thing. For some people, not so good.
Brett,
I'm still close with Brett, and I see him a lot when I'm on the West Coast. Tama wrote a memoir recently, and although I didn't know this until recently, she was furious at me because at some point I was asked why I didn't do vodka and clothing ads, and I said I thought that writers should not, you know, compromise their veracity by, you know, selling their endorsements. And and Tama was doing that very thing, and so she was furious at me for years, although I didn't realize it. So I think I'm on her shit list.
It sounds like.
But Brett and I really did become close friends, and there was a point where we had dinner every Friday night, and we've sort of figured if the press is going to throw us together, we might as well just go for it. And then he ended up borrowing some of my characters, and
that's cheating.
I think it was a big joke to him, and it was pretty funny. And I ultimately, after a brief moment of bristling, I thought it was pretty funny too.
Let me ask you about.
I don't think anything quite like that has happened since. You know, for better or for worse. You know, I don't feel like there's. You know, I mean, back before us, there were the Beats. You know, Ginsberg and Burroughs. Kerouac, and to some extent, Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer and Truman Capote formed a sort of a triumvirate, and they were on talk shows, and people knew who they were. I don't know if that happens anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there's still obviously celebrity writers around, but maybe not to the same degree. There's so many other distractions these days. I mean, it was Philip Roth who said the era of the novel is over. I don't know that I believe that. I'm going to ask you about that. But first, I want to ask you, here you are. There's a saying that a rock band or any band has your whole life to write your first album and 6 months to write your second album. You must have come off Bright Lights, Big City. The publishing company must have been excited and said, you got to get another book out there, Jay. So let's go for it. And you have the pressure of this freshman success, and there's something called the sophomore jinx. You write a book called Ransom that you were happy with, but did not meet the expectation. I mean, it didn't equal Bright Lights, Big City. Talk about how, I mean, were you conscious of that pressure, and were they pressing you to get another book out there rapidly?
Well, you know, I actually had another book. Ransom was, I don't know, probably three quarters written when I sort of took time off to write Bright Lights, Big City. You know, Ransom was a very traditional kind of expatriate novel based on my 2 years of living in Japan. And I was just having trouble with it. And so it was sort of like having an affair on your wife. I just kind of cheated on Ransom by writing Bright Lights, Big City in about 6 weeks. And suddenly I was compelled by this second person voice and this story about the worst things that had ever happened to me in my life up to that point. And I put Ransom aside. So when Bright Lights was out there, I had something else to publish. You know, I mean, I spent another 3 weeks or, I mean, 3 months or so on Ransom. And then I published it. The problem is that Ransom is definitely a first novel and a kind of a apprentice effort. And I think it was the wrong novel to publish right after Bright Lights, Big City. And also everybody wanted me to write about New York. You know, they didn't want me to write about karate in Japan and so on. Although subsequently there was a bit of a rash of Americans in Japan novels, some of which were well received. But Ransom was basically an apprentice work, which I published after a really successful first novel.
So, I'm glad you mentioned 6 weeks because that's one of the other things about Bright Lights, Big City is you often hear artists of all stripes say that my greatest work that I've ever done, or the greatest works that I've ever done, they came very quickly because they had incubated, they had developed, they'd coalesce, and then it was just bam. That appears to have been the case with Bright Lights. How describe that a little bit. Did you, was this something that you had incubating in your head for months or years, and then when you decided it's time to pull the trigger on it, it really just spilled out?
Well, it must have been. So back in, oh boy, I'm trying to think of dates now, but back around 1981, I was writing short stories, and I sent a short story off to the Paris Review, and George Plimpton liked the story, but he called me up, and I can't even imitate his voice. It's very funny, but he asked me if I had anything else to send him. And so that night I went through kind of everything in my drawer, and the only thing that I could find that I thought was interesting was this paragraph I had written at like 4 in the morning after coming home from a nightclub. And it was basically the first paragraph of Bright Lights, Big City. You're not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are. And so on and so on. I had scribbled this down back in 1980 after a sort of disastrous night at a nightclub. And I thought, this is the only original thing in my pile of works in progress. I mean, the voice struck me as really original. So that night, I pretty much stayed up all night, and I wrote a short story. It's only about 12 pages, about a guy at a nightclub who's trying to heal his broken heart, unsuccessfully, of course, and who's whacked out of his mind on cocaine. And then I sent that to George Plimpton. It was called "It's 6 a.m. Do You Know Where You Are?"
I love that line.
So Plimpton immediately called me and said, "I'm publishing this," and to the point where I couldn't even make any corrections, which I tried to do. He just ran it in no time at all, and it caused a stir. You know, in the literary world, people were kind of excited by it. So I was still struggling with this Japan novel. And one day I woke up in the morning, I said, what if I just try to keep going with this short story in the second person? And frankly, it had taken me a while to realize it was in the second person. And very, it was a summer. So I was in graduate school, but this might have been, you know, end of May when I sat down to write this thing. And in very short order, about 6 weeks, I wrote a short novel, which in the end was called Bright Lights, Big City, went through many titles. And my roommate from Williams College was working at Random House at the time. I sent it to him, and he gave it to Jason Epstein, and suddenly, suddenly I had a publishing contract.
And this was a signature novel of the 1980s. Talk about, compare and contrast the 1980s versus where we are now. Here we are in 2024. The world has changed a lot. Technologically, it's changed a lot. Socially, it's changed a lot. Talk about the 80s versus where we are today.
Well, you know, it's funny. The 80s, in some ways, they have this reputation of, the decadent decade, and one of the interesting things about the 80s is that it's really the last decade that has a signature visual style. If you see a photograph of me in 1985, you know it's 1985 between the clothing and the haircut and so on. But likewise, the architecture and the cars and everything. But the 80s was supposed to be so decadent with the cocaine and the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 3,000 and Wall Street bankers were throwing their weight around and so on. And
They were doing a lot of cocaine too.
they were doing, but when you look back at it now, the 80s seem kind of quaint and almost cute compared to what has followed. But it was a smaller world then. It was, without social media, without so-called quality television, without the internet, it was just, it was an easier world to navigate, really. On the other hand, it was also scary and almost apocalyptic in the sense that in my community in particular, which was downtown creative New York, you suddenly had this plague which arose amongst us, called, which was AIDS, of course. And we were pretty freaked out. More than, the crowd that I traveled in was at least half gay. And suddenly people were getting sick. People were getting these Kaposi sarcoma sort of blotches on their skin. People were dying, and it took a while to figure out what was going on. And half a generation of creative people kind of got scythed down. So on the one hand, there was this incredible innocence and exuberance, and then on the other hand, death was stalking us. I don't think there will be another decade like it. And likewise, as I said, I don't think there will be, I don't think there is any longer the opportunity for a novelist to make the cultural impact that some did at that time.
Does that suggest that you agree with Philip Roth that the era of the novel is over?
Well, unfortunately, that's tends to be what like 75-year-old guys say when they're on their way out.
When they're running out of material.
Yeah, when they're exactly. Although to his credit, he didn't really run out of material.
No, he was, God, he could be so productive in his late years. That's got to be inspirational to you or any novelist out there.
But I wonder if I were, if I were 15-year-old Jay McInerney now, I wonder if I would consider the novel to be the most vital form of communication as I did back when I was 15 years old. And I'm not sure that I would. I mean, I was utterly dedicated to that mission, that goal.
What would you tell
There's so
a
many, there's
what
so
would
many more ways to express yourself and to reach the public now. And
Exactly.
there's no question that, if I would, my heroes were Hemingway and Fitzgerald and James Joyce, and those guys were they were the cultural icons of their time.
Yeah.
They were the ones who, to me, were the most creative. Well, since painting and music didn't come naturally to me, they were the most creative figures of their time.
What would you say to a 25-year-old Jay McInerney, knowing what you know now, if you could go back in time, that 15-year-old or 20 or 25-year-old Jay McInerney? What sentence, what piece of advice would you just can convey and just say, listen, but I want to give you a little guidance here and just keep this in mind. What would you tell that your young self?
I might tell my young self something that Norman Mailer said to me when we were walking from a some sort of movie premiere to the restaurant where we were going to have the dinner to celebrate the movie. And Norman and I in particular were being swarmed by photographers. And also Norman had his very beautiful wife, Norris, with him. Norman said to me, "Be careful of those flash bulbs, Jay. They can bleach your soul." And what he meant by that, obviously, was, you know, be careful of how you embrace this celebrity. And you know, I think if I had the chance to go back, I would embrace it a little less, because I don't know, it's very seductive and it's very dangerous. Like, you know, like a beautiful, fickle woman who may be gone the next morning before you realize it.
Yeah, the Norwegian wood syndrome.
Yes.
So did this take you away from your work? The celebrity was such that, you know, you enjoyed it at the time anyway. Did you find that you were doing less writing because you were too involved in the nightlife?
Well, you know, fortunately, when you're young, you're very driven. And I think that I, you know, I continue to work pretty steadily. But yeah, there's probably a book somewhere, a ghost book somewhere back there that didn't get written, which I read. You know, if I hadn't written the screenplay, there certainly would have been another novel. I guess I'm glad I wrote the screenplay because, you know, I made a lot of money and I learned from my mistakes. But one of the things I learned is that I'm a novelist and not a screenwriter. I've subsequently written maybe 10 of them, but I'm still not very good.
Do you see, I don't want to spend the time talking just about Bright Lights, Big City, but do you see that book as an annoyance as well, that all people want to talk about is Bright Lights, Big City, but I've written all this other material that I think is good and people don't reference it nearly as much as Bright Lights, Big City. Is it in a sense kind of an annoyance?
Well, there came a point in the middle of my career really where I just get so tired of talking about Bright Lights and you know, and I would get so tired of people coming up to me and say, "Oh, love your book." And I would want to say, "Well, I've written 10, which one are you talking about?" But that would be disingenuous. I was kind of sick of it for a while until eventually I realized that, you know, as I said to you earlier, the goal with Bright Lights, Big City was getting a few good reviews and getting a teaching job somewhere in the Midwest. And instead, I got a career as a full-time novelist, and I was able to devote myself entirely to writing. And and Bright Lights gave me a certain fame, which still hasn't worn off entirely. And I finally did, and you know, and I finally reread it a few years ago and decided, you know what, I'm pretty proud of this. So now I've gotten over my resentment of Bright Lights, Big City, but I certainly had it for a while.
Well, and there's so many authors out there who have a particular novel that is the one that's going to stand the test of time, and they've written a lot of other great stuff. But to have, I mean, look at John Updike. I mean, he was, I forget who the critic was, who said John Updike's a great novelist who's never written a truly great novel. And
you know, that's funny you say that, because I was trying to think which one are you about to mention, because I can't. But for me, with John Updike, it's the Rabbit trilogy or tetralogy, whichever. And in my case, I think certainly in terms of reviews, the best reviews I've gotten have been for this this trilogy I wrote about this young glamorous New York couple, starting with the novel called Brightness Falls. And I don't know. I think in the long run, that may be the one that's. Or that may be the accomplishment that's talked about a little more.
Brightness Falls.
Brightness Falls.
Now, wasn't that? I'm testing my memory right now, so check me on this. I thought I had read a quote from you in an interview situation where you said, "I thought to myself, what would the Bonfire of the Vanities be like if it had been written with heart?" And then yeah. You is that right?
That was certainly one of the things that I threw out there. But also I was thinking of, you know, the social novels of, like, you know, Vanity Fair, and, you know, Thackeray and Trollope and Dickens. And I was thinking, what if somebody, you know, what if I wrote a more panoramic novel of New York City in the 80s and more like the 19th century social realism novels? And so that was what started me off on Brightness Falls, which, I don't know, in my mind, that's the best written of all of my books. And I subsequently sort of revisited those characters every 10 years for the next 30 years, I guess. And then the last installment was called Bright Precious Days. And it's, I don't know, that may have been the best reviews I ever got in my career. And huh. I just finished a novel which is going to end it all, called See You on the Other Side.
Why did you say you're going to end it all?
Well, one of the main, this is the last one. I mean, it ends this series, at least, because one of the main characters dies. So I really can't.
Ah, I see. Okay.
I did that deliberately.
You killed off a character. You have to do that sometimes.
Yeah, but I mean, fortunately, I have the next novel in mind, which has nothing to do with that series. But
so you're still writing.
I think John Updike's greatest achievement was the Rabbit series of novels: Rabbit Run, Rabbit Redux.
We won two Pulitzer Prizes for those.
Yeah.
My favorite was Villages. I never wrote Villages.
He never wrote a book like Catch 22 or Catcher in the Rye or.
Yes. Yeah. And,
I guess in Mailer's case, it was The Naked and the Dead.
Yeah, for sure.
I think I wrote a lot of good books without, yeah, writing one of those books that displaced the others, really. You know, it's interesting. And I think his career at the moment is a bit his reputation's a bit in the doldrums compared to someone like Roth, who was his main competitor.
Yeah. I think so. You know, in 2010, you delivered a commencement speech at Williams College, which is your alma mater. Mm-hmm. What did you tell the students?
I think the short version is fake it until you make it. I mean, just to put it in terms of writing, I talked about the fact that for the first 5 years of my writing life, I just imitated everybody that I liked. I imitated Hemingway and I imitated Fitzgerald and Opta.
Carver? Did you imitate Carver?
Oh yeah, Carver. When I was in graduate school, Carver was it. Everybody was imitating Carver. And as different as his sensibility and subject matter was from me, I was just, to me, reading Carver for the first time was like what it must have been like to read, you know, Hemingway back in 1925.
The spareness of the writing and
spareness of the perfection of the writing, the imitation of dialogue, the economy, you know, it was just really something. And I think Carver was consciously imitating Hemingway to some extent, but he became a mentor to me, even though we could not be more different stylistically and in terms of subject matter. I mean, here was a guy who wrote about like laundromats and bottles of ketchup on the table in the trailer park. And you know, I'd never even been to a trailer park. And he'd never been to New York City. And yet somehow we bonded, and he read all my work for 2 years and red penciled it. You know, he would say things to me like, why do you say earth here, Jay? What you mean is dirt. Don't say earth if you mean dirt, you know? And those lessons stuck, even though I never wrote a book about working class people in the Pacific Northwest.
Right. So, I'm on my third wife, so no judgment here, but you've been married three times, like me.
Four.
Four times, make that four. So, is there something about your lifestyle about, I realize this is a personal question about the temp, they always talk about artists being temperamental. A good day of writing makes a guy happy, a bad day of writing, and there's you're petulant. Did the fact that you're a writer and the vicissitudes of writing, did that was that a problem during any of your marriages?
Well, I think my first wife was probably ambushed by the success of Bright Lights, Big City. I mean, it would have been very hard for any marriage to have survived what happened to me in 1984, when suddenly I was just, swamped by this wave of attention and acclaim, and she kind of got washed away by all of that. And she also, she was emotionally fragile in a way that particularly made her susceptible to all of that. I would say that I was probably subjected to more temptation than most people were at that time.
Oh, sure.
And
Yeah.
subsequently.
You're surrounded by the beautiful people.
And I have a, yeah. And I have a re relatively short attention span. I don't know. I mean, I think Mailer had seven wives. So,
Yes.
and Hemingway. Well, Hemingway had four. So,
Yeah, it's a what do they call that? That's a professional.
when I married Anne, my current wife, she said, "All right, Hemingway had four, and that's all you get." So,
Yeah, that's a good stopping point right there.
yes, I'm finished.
So the
But
current.
I think there was also a certain, I mean, looking back, there was a certain sense that I was kind of experimenting with my own life and almost blowing it up to see what would happen so I could write about it, you know? I mean, I'm not proud of that, but I think it's possible that that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that's unusual either. I mean, musically, I think that not to compare you two in any sense, but Taylor Swift seems to like to date guys and break up with them and then write an album about how it was really him who that she was the victim in the whole thing and writes these laments. Now you are currently working on something, so it's good to hear that you're not haven't reached a point like Philip Roth eventually did and say, "Well, I'm retired now, I'm done."
No, I during the pandemic, I wrote a memoir. I wrote a short novel, which I'm still fooling around with, and I just finished a month ago this 400-page novel called "See You on the Other Side," which God knows when it, I haven't given it to my publisher yet, but I probably will in the next few months. So even, I mean, it seems like I haven't been doing much, but I actually have three books that are in the pipeline. So
Wow.
we'll see. But no, I'm definitely not. And then I have the next one in my mind. So I haven't
No,
retired.
and you're not running out of ideas. It's not the sort of thing where you, it sounds like you've got a pipeline of ideas that
And I write journalism too, which I enjoy. And I write the wine criticism, which I enjoy.
Let's talk about wine a little bit. You're obviously a connoisseur, a fancier, a connoisseur. Do you have a pin? Are you a sommelier? Have you studied it to that degree that you're a somm, or are is it just that you're a connoisseur of
No,
wine?
I'm an amateur. I mean, I think I've won some pins for my writing, but it was just, when I published Bright Lights, Big City, I suddenly had some money to spend on wine, and curiously enough, I got the phone call telling me that the book had been accepted at a liquor store in Syracuse, New York,
Perfect.
I was working part time to support myself, and so I. It was kind of a crummy liquor store, but there was this shelf of like really good Bordeaux and stuff, which was gathering dust because mostly we sold to winos. So I took home the best bottle I could find there that night and opened it up, and even though I've had better wine since, that may have been the best bottle in a sense of my life because You know, I just sold my first novel, and
You had to celebrate, yeah.
so then
What?
when I started making money from Bright Lights, the 1982 Bordeaux vintage was released into the market, and this was one of the greatest vintages of modern times, and so I bought a whole bunch, and you know, I started reading. I befriended when I went on my European book tour. I befriended Julian Barnes, the novelist who's also a great wine connoisseur. And so we started faxing each other about what wine we were drinking, and it was just a hobby. But in 1995, my friend Dominique Browning took over House and Garden magazine, and she wanted to have a wine column because she thought it was something people cared about now. And so she asked me to write about it, and I said, "Well, look, I don't really think I know enough." And she said, "Well, look, most wine writing is boring, and technical, and not of interest to the general reader." And she said, I think you could make it really fun and interesting. Write about the people, write about what you don't know." And so I agreed to do it for 6 months, and I'm still doing it.
Yeah, so
5 years later, I was the wine critic for the Wall Street Journal for 4 or 5 years, and after House and Garden folded,
that's a great gig.
now I write for a couple of magazines, including Town and Country, and an English magazine called Noble Rot. And I mean, it's sort of a relief from the fiction, you know. It's like some days, I shouldn't say this, but you know, if I should happen to, on a rare occasion, wake up really hungover, I can still write about wine.
Right. What's your favorite grape?
Pinot Noir.
Yeah, okay,
Pinot
there you
Noir
go.
is the base grape. It's the grape of Burgundy, and to me, it has the most complexity, the most subtlety. It has the ability to taste one way, you know, in Chambord-Musigny, and then right next door, in Vosne-Romanée, it tastes completely different. And if you work at it hard enough, you can sometimes tell the difference, blind, without prompting. And it's, I don't know, it's it, to me, it's also somewhat heartbreaking, because it can be really great, and it can be really bad. It's like,
Yes.
but you know,
Yeah.
it's like Pinot Noir fans are like Mets fans, you know. They're used to having their heart broken, and Cabernet fans are like Yankees fans, you know. They don't They're used to winning.
Speaking, I'm glad you're pairing wines right now with something other than food, because I was going to ask you if for the reader out there who just heard you say, I think Brightness Falls is my best written novel. So they're going to dive into Brightness Falls. What wine would you pair with Brightness Falls? Is that even a fair question? Could you pair a particular wine with that novel?
Well, with Brightness Falls, it probably wouldn't be a very, it's such a big sprawling book. I would probably compare it with a Chateauneuf, well, I would probably pair it with a Chateauneuf du Pape from the Rhone Valley in France,
Hmm.
which is kind of what I was drinking back then too.
Yeah. Do you write under the influence of anything? Do you sip wine while you're writing? Do you ever use cannabis? Do you use caffeine? Is there anything you write under the influence of?
Mostly caffeine. There was, you know, when I was waiting for Bright Light, when I went to George Plimpton's house, which was where all the great literary parties took place in New York when there still were such things, and I met Truman Capote. It was a very sad meeting, really. But you know, Capote, this is in 1984, and Capote kind of dragged me into George Plimpton's office, and of course tried to grope me and whatnot. But he had a bag of cocaine, so I sort of put up with it, and we did some cocaine together. And he said, "You know, this is the great secret of writing. You know, you can write forever and brilliantly." And you know what? It isn't, because I tried to write on coke. And you know, you sit down to write on coke, and next thing you know, you're picking up the phone. You know, you're like, you know, you're looking at the paper. Cocaine is a terrible stimulant for writing. The only, you know, I've written under the influence of alcohol too, but I somehow don't in general find it to be the right kind of stimulus. The only The only time I use alcohol is if I've been writing all day, I will inevitably reward myself with, a nice meal and some wine. And then sometimes I go back to my computer and the 3 or 4 pages that I wrote that day, I will then rewrite under the, somewhat under the influence of some wine. And sometimes it loosens things up in a good way. But that's after it's already down on paper.
So do you go out to eat a lot? I mean, do you run into Gay Talese drinking his gin martini at the bar?
I see Gay a fair amount. He's Gay is one of my Gay is one of my oldest literary friends in New York.
He's a
I was very,
great
I was very
guy.
lucky. Most of those guys were very nice to me when I came along. Norman Mailer, Gay Talese, Robert Stone, they kind of, they kind of embraced me and encouraged me, whereas they could have been jerks.
Exactly. It's
George
kind of like
Payne.
when Shaquille O'Neal joined the NBA, all Kareem Jabbar and all the other, I mean, Hakeem Olajuwon, they all were just trying to let's show this kid, this snot-nosed kid, a thing or two. But they weren't that like that with you. It's
No,
a testament to their character.
William Styron. I mean, they were nice to me. They were, and they were intrigued. Like here's this young version of me out there. I was
Exactly.
pretty lucky that I was not always lucky with the what I call the guardians of the culture and the gatekeepers and the critics, but I was always lucky with the. I was always taken care of by the older, established writers, guys like that.
Talk about your writing regimen. What is your work ethic like and your work style? Are you a morning writer? How long do you
Yeah,
go? Where do you do your writing?
I'm mostly a morning writer. If I don't get started by noon, I just feel like I've lost it. But I'm not an early morning person. But when I'm really writing, the more involved in the novel I am, the earlier I get up, so that let's say finishing up this recent book, the last 10 days that I was at it, I was waking up earlier and earlier because I was thinking about it, and I was at my desk by 7:30, say, and working for, I don't know, 5, 6 hours at a time. In general, though, I don't get to my desk till about 9. I have some coffee, and then I come to my desk, and I work until lunch. And if it's good, then I might work after lunch. And if it's not good, I'm discouraged, and I don't work after lunch.
Right. So a lot of times writers have these turning points in their career. Obviously, Bright Lights, Big City was a it was the launch and a turning point. Post Bright Lights, Big City, was there a second turning point in your career? Something a time when you suddenly took on a new direction, or you found a new confidence, or maybe even just a different mindset that made you feel like, this is chapter two for me right now.
Well, I think my fourth novel was what's called Brightness Falls, and that was a I mean it was a big novel. It's like it was almost 500 pages, and it was a panoramic novel that took place over 2 or 3 years, and encompassed a lot of characters. And I think that was a turning point for me because all my novels up to that point had all taken place in a relatively short span of like a week basically, and they've been kind of snapshots, and that book was more like an album, and I thought, I can do this. I can write the big ambitious novels, and which is not to say that I would always do that, because the short punchy novel will always have its place. Julian Barnes is always saying to me, "Why are you writing these long novels? You could write two short novels in the same time."
Do
I don't know.
novellas, never mind novels, do
Yeah, which
novellas.
is kind of what he does, but I don't know. Somehow I like the idea of de dealing with multiple characters over time, and that was a turning point for me.
So speaking of over time, as you age, your writing has changed as you've aged, but you're still a young guy, and you've got a lot of track ahead of you, God willing. How do you think your writing's going to change as you age? I mean, this one that you're coming out with now, which is about the end. This is the end, my only friend, the end.
Well, the end of this particular story.
Yes, but as people get older, they tend to write about death maybe more than when they're younger. But as you get older, do you say, if you look 10, 20, 25 years down the road, do you think in terms of how your writing might change? Or
I just,
how has it changed to date, and how do you expect it to change going forward?
well, it's, I just had brain surgery 5 weeks ago, so I'm trying to figure out what.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. On December 20th, I had a really bad concussion, and eventually I had to have brain surgery, and they drilled two holes in my head, and I was in the hospital for a week. And I'm still wondering about whether that is going to change my outlook on life. It's certainly the first brush with mortality that I've ever had. And I feel in many ways like I've been 20, 29 years old for the last 40 or 45 years. But now I'm thinking a little harder about all of this. But it's very recent,
So they had
But
to relieve
when you get to
pressure.
be
There's some
my age,
swelling. There was swelling of
yeah,
the brain, and just had to relieve pressure.
I had a what's called a subdural hematoma, which is bleeding in the back of in my skull. And there came a point where they said, I was getting a CAT scan every week. And one day I went in for a CAT scan, and then I was on my way to dinner, and I got a call from the hospital. I said, "You need to come in right away." And I said, "Well, let me go to dinner first." And they said, "No, you have to come. You don't understand. You have to come in now."
Wow. That had
And
to be scary.
I was really kind of irritated, but I went in, and I spent a week in the hospital. So yeah, I'm thinking much more about those things. And I'm grateful that that I came out. And strangely enough, I came out and spent 9 days finishing a novel that I hadn't been able to look at for 3 months. So, I think there's a certain gratitude that comes with surviving something like that.
Absolutely. I
I'm
never would have
still,
guessed. I mean, you look great, you sound great. There's no sense of, any kind of brain concussion or injury.
I have this wild mane of hair because I'm not allowed to. I haven't been allowed to cut my hair because
You shouldn't. It's part of your
I have
signature.
this massive, massive scar on my head.
Oh,
Although
is that right?
But for some reason I didn't shave my head. I don't know why.
Well, you've got a gray head of hair, so you keep that. You just wouldn't look like Jay McInerney without it. So, Jay, I know you've got a hard stop. I really appreciate you taking the time. Again, Bright Lights, Big City was just a seminal novel in early in my life, and it's just a pleasure to get to meet you and spend some time with you.
Thank
Thanks for coming on
you.
the program.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate revisiting and rethinking about some of these things. Thanks very much.